when people criticize me for not waiting longer or, you know, whatever they've decided is best for me. It hurts because really I risk it. I risk it every day that I wake up. And I do it because I still feel good enough and I still have enough joy and I still laugh and smile with my family and friends enough that it doesn't seem like the right time right now. But it will come because I feel myself getting sicker. It's happening each week.
Brittany Maynard, a 29-year-old with brain cancer who ended her life in Oregon 3 years ago. She spoke on CNN. Oregon was the first state to enact a right-to-die law, which lets terminally ill patients ask their doctors for drugs to end their lives. Here in California, aid in dying has been legal now for 1 year. And yesterday, the California Department of Public Health reported that 111 people took their lives within the first 6 months it was available. Most were white, college-educated patients over 60 years old who had cancer and had health insurance. But there's also a lawsuit in the works to overturn California's law. We'll hear some pro and con voices in a moment. But first, a personal story. Bob Stone was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a bone marrow cancer. He entered hospice on June 9th, 2016, the day the law took effect in California. He was one of the first Californians to legally request and use the end-of-life prescription. He died in September. His ex-wife, Roberta, was at his side, and they had remained close after their divorce. And Roberta, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you.
Well, before we talk about the end of Bob's life, why don't you tell us a little bit about him? What was he like?
Bob was a person who loved life. Everything he did totally. He couldn't sort of do something. He just threw himself into everything. Bob worked in low-income housing, and he worked for a number of organizations in downtown L.A., and then he opened his own consulting business and traveled through the United States working with different nonprofits to assist them in their providing low-income housing.
Well, when did you two start talking about what kind of death he wanted?
When Bob was diagnosed, he researched multiple myeloma. He knew exactly what to expect. And he said, I'm not going to stick around for the really painful part. He had chemotherapy, 16 weeks of chemotherapy that prolonged his life with quality. But it was not a permanent fix.
First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I'm thinking of the doctors that who have criticized death with dignity laws because they say that it's not medical treatment, that it violates the basic Hippocratic Oath, do no harm. After going through this with Bob, what's your perspective on that?
I think that this is doing no harm. This is following a dying person's wishes. Bob was not going to get out of this alive, period. He had the option to go through it to the very end or take a shortcut, and he took a shortcut. He met with his palliative care team, and looking at the numbers from all of his tests, knowing his body, what it felt like, he knew that it was only going to get worse, and his doctors confirmed that. He'd be out and he'd have to go home. He'd be in pain. He'd just be so lethargic. This was not the Bob Stone that he knew and wanted to be.
Well, in a lot of ways, I think this is the kind of situation where you have to have lived through it to really know what it's going to be like.
Absolutely.
So for people who haven't been in your situation, what would you say to them that they need to understand in order to think more clearly about their options and aid in dying or even just about the end of life in general?
I would say that this option is not for everyone. I know that. But the fact is that we all have to face death at some point, and some of us will have options about that death. for anyone who makes the decision that Bob made, for their loved ones, I would just want to share my experience. Bob took a shortcut, and he passed the worst of the pain. He lived every day of his life to the fullest. And then he and I snuggled up together, and he died peacefully and quickly.
Well, since Bob passed away, you've spent a lot of time advocating for this cause. What's it been like for you as an advocate? What kind of response have you gotten from the people that you've talked with, and have you dealt with people have strong feelings about this and any pushback?
There have been some people who have been opposed to this, and that's their right. And there have been some people who have asked a lot of questions, and I have friends that have said this has really brought it to the front, and it's something to think about. And it is just one of the options to think about.
Do you have a plan for the end of your life?
Yes, Bob and I were in total agreement, and I... Of course, we all plan to die in our sleep, go to bed happy and die in our sleep. If that doesn't work out for me, I definitely would do this.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking about this. It's so hard to talk about, and I appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Roberta Stone, her husband was one of the first Californians to use the right to die law. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Well, now let's bring in two more voices on this issue. Dr. Daniel Solmasi, professor of medicine and medical ethics at Georgetown University. He's critical of aid in dying laws. And we're also going to talk to Kevin Diaz, director of legal affairs for Compassion and Choices, a group that supports these laws. And thank you very much, both of you, for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Dr. Solmasi. What do you make of Roberta's story?
Well, I think one's heart always goes out to anyone who has lost a husband or other loved one. And I think that her story, while it's compelling, is also in some ways illustrative of some of the potential issues with these kinds of laws and the kinds of misunderstandings that can sometimes lead people to make this kind of choice. I mean, I agree with her that we need to face death, and we don't do a good job of that in this country. But, when she says he didn't want to be in pain, it seems to me that that's a failure of medicine, because we are, in fact, capable of treating pain better than we ever have been in the history of medicine. And no one should opt for suicide because they fear they're going to be in pain. We can do a better job of that.
So you're saying even at the end of life, you can manage end of life in a way such that people shouldn't have the option to choose how to do that?
They shouldn't need to have it. So I think that the polls that one gets from Gallup and others say, imagine you were in excruciating pain. Should you have the option to choose to have your doctor help you die? I mean, that's the kind of poll. But that's a caricature given contemporary hospice and palliative care. We can treat people's pain even if it takes making them unconscious. We can treat symptoms of nausea better than we ever have in the history of humankind as well. And so the real reasons that most people give actually for in polls in Oregon and other places are things like feeling like a burden on others or tiredness of life. It's not really for symptoms, and people need to know that.
Kevin Diaz, Director of Legal Affairs for Compassion and Choices. What are your thoughts listening to Dr. Solmasi?
Well, I think that the main point is that really what matters is whether or not the patient is in the driver's seat when it comes to the care that they're receiving, and that they should be the one who gets to determine whether their suffering is too great or not at the end of life. While I would love to, I would love to agree with the professor about medicine's ability to treat all pain. I can't say that I agree with that statement. And one of the things that he referred to is essentially palliative sedation, which is the only way they can treat the pain is essentially to put you under. And I frankly don't understand the distinction between allowing someone to choose medical aid and dying for themselves versus having to wait till the very end where it's insanely unbearable to where a physician would put you in a coma until you died. That, you know, seems to be a distinction without a difference. So,
there are other objections. The lawsuit right now against the California law says that the law violates Californian civil rights by stripping terminally ill patients of certain legal protections and treating them differently than other patients. I'm quoting. What is the objection? What are they getting to there?
I think what they're trying to allege is that somehow terminally ill patients are not being protected by the state. And, you know, this lawsuit really harkens back to a lawsuit that was brought to try to stop the implementation of the Oregon law. And ultimately what the courts found was that the plaintiffs really hadn't brought any concrete examples of anyone who is harmed. This is really all theoretical. And I think the same thing is happening here in the California case. And, you know, while they may quibble with some of the procedures that are required to qualify for the act, ultimately, my guess is that their position that under any circumstances this shouldn't be allowed. And frankly, you know, somebody else making that kind of gut-wrenching, intimate decision that really should be made for oneself in consultation with their loved ones, their medical team, and spiritual providers, really is offensive.
Dr. Solmasi, if this is a concern that patients might be getting bad advice or might be is somehow coerced into these decisions, is there a way to amend the law to better assess patients' intentions or to make sure they get good advice? I mean, is there a version of this kind of law that you could support?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I mean, one of the things that people who push for legislation like this don't really fully appreciate is the intimacy of the doctor-patient relationship and the amount of trust that patients need to be able to have in us in order to be able to reveal very intimate secrets about their own lives, things they sometimes don't even tell their spouses, and sort of what sets the conditions that allows that trust to be in place are certain time-honored conditions that physicians set as the boundaries on that.
Although
I will not have sex with you. I will not kill you. I will not disclose your secrets. And once we begin to erode those kinds of boundaries, I think there's a lot of potential for mischief in these sorts of circumstances.
Well, the law, of course, allows doctors to turn down the requests that they receive from patients for this kind of care. And Kevin Diaz, how hard is it to find doctors who are willing to get involved in this process, hearing Dr. Solmasi's concerns?
Well, certainly as the law was being implemented in California, there were an awful lot of questions. But the state recently, in fact, I think it might have been as recently as yesterday, released data for the first 6 months. And I think the thing that is so encouraging about the implementation of the law in California is that you saw an incredibly diverse number of physicians prescribing medical aid in dying. I think it was something like 173 unique physicians making the prescription for 190 some patients, and that's something that I think speaks to the success of the implementation and the enormous efforts that we and others have been putting forth to make sure that all physicians have the tools and the ability to talk candidly and compassionately with their patients. I think that's a really good sign.
Dr. Solmasi, I'm thinking back to Roberta, our first guest, who argued that she felt you could do more harm by making a terminally ill patient like her ex-husband, Bob, continue to live and suffer through the very end of their disease and treatment. And if they want to end their lives, that's their body and their right. Patients, after all, they refuse treatment in order to hasten or bring about their death, and that's a very hard way to go. What about that argument?
Yeah, well, first of all, suicide is not illegal. So people who do want to end their lives can. I'm opposed to it and would discourage anyone from committing suicide. But one of the real issues here is whether the physician should be involved. You were talking again about the kinds of possibilities within the setting of the doctor-patient relationship for abuse of this. And one piece of data that's come out of Oregon is the remarkably few number of patients who make this request who are ever actually sent to a psychiatrist to assess whether they have the decision-making capacity to actually freely make this choice. Many patients become interested in dying as they are terminally ill and think about it. A large number of them are depressed, and one of the main symptoms of depression is suicidal ideation, and people who are dying can be sad, but depression is something that can be treated when people are dying, so that we have as our view that we help them to live and to flourish as best they can, even while they're dying.
We're going to have to end it here. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Daniel Solmasi, Professor of Medicine and Medical Ethics at Georgetown University's Critical of Aid in Dying Laws. Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
And also thank you to you, Kevin Diaz, Director of Legal Affairs for Compassion and Choices.
My pleasure.
Well, where do you stand on the right to die law? Should doctors be able to prescribe drugs to terminally ill patients who want to end their lives early? You can weigh in on Facebook at KCRW. Press play. Coming up, what is it like to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in the dark, in the desert, barefoot, and in danger? It's a new immersive art exhibit at LACMA from the director of The Revenant. We have a review. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Madeline Brand. Carne y Arena, or Flesh and Sand, was the first virtual reality project to be officially selected to play at the Cannes Film Festival. This Sunday, it opens at the L.A. County Museum of Art. It was created by Mexican filmmaker Alejandro Iñárritu and his cinematographer, Emmanuel Lubezki. Iñárritu is best known for films like The Revenant and Birdman. But Carne y Arena is not a movie. Instead, it's a means for museum goers to get a close-up view in virtual reality of the harrowing experience of migrants crossing our southern border. Carolina Miranda writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times, and she often joins us here on Press Play to talk art. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So take us through the experience. How does it start?
Well, this is an installation. In addition to the virtual reality experience, it's also a bit of an installation. So the first thing that you walk into is actually not the VR, but this room that is constructed to look like the detention centers used by the Border Patrol, commonly called hieleras, which means icebox because they are air-conditioned to the point of teeth chattering. And you sit in this room by yourself amid shoes that an artist has gathered on the border, real shoes left by real migrants in the Sonoran Desert, for a few minutes before they admit you to see the VR. And I think what that does is it really just puts you in the mindset of what it means and the risks at stake of crossing the border before actually going on to experience the video part, the virtual reality part of the installation.
So you're cold, and it's a way to make you feel vulnerable, too. And I think that you take off your shoes as well, right?
Exactly. You're asked to take off your shoes. Your shoes, you leave your belongings, you sit in this room, you don't really know what's happening. There's a sign that says, you know, once the door flashes, you're allowed to come through. So it's this very, you know, challenging, very chilly. I mean, I found myself hugging myself because I was shaking from the cold in the room.
Wow.
And then with the shoes of actual migrants that were found in the desert. So these mementos from these very difficult journeys that you're surrounded by in this room. It's a very reflective moment that you have there before you go in.
What happens after the holding cell?
After the holding cell, you're admitted to a larger room that is covered in sand and dirt and pebbles and a replica of what looks like the U.S.-Mexico border barrier, the existing one in its corrugated metal. And that's where a team of gallery assistants outfit you with a virtual reality headset. And you experience a 6.5-minute virtual reality experience that puts you right into the desert with a group of immigrants as they are trying to cross into the U.S. And I don't know how much detail you want me to give away about the plot of the experience. I sometimes think less is more.
Well, first,
you are witness to an incident.
There is a plot. Okay.
There is a little bit of a plot. I mean, it's 6.5 minutes, so it's a short film. And what you are witness to is an incident on the border. And I think what is so striking about it is, first of all, you are in this room and you feel breezes as if you are outdoors. The gallery kind of puts wind going through so that you're standing looking at what looks like the southern desert border, and you're feeling the wind and you're feeling the sand and the pebbles and the dirt between your toes. And you witness this group of migrants come over a small rise and this incident, and you are right there in the middle of it. And it is really, like, I found myself startled at moments, jumping back, moving my arms out of the way. Like, even though it's all digitally rendered, there is something so visceral about the experience that it becomes incredibly powerful.
And then, as you say, you move into this other part of the exhibit where you see short biographical sketches, right? Videos?
Exactly. So you go from that experience into a narrow hallway that leads you out that has about a dozen video portraits shot by Lubetzky. They're beautifully shot of the immigrants on whose stories this is based. And these really moving, tragic stories about the journeys that they made coming into the U.S. and the pain and the danger that they experienced, all the way from why it is they immigrated. Maybe they were being threatened by gang members in Central America. Maybe there was no economic opportunity for them in Mexico. And then the dangers of crossing. One woman telling a story about a little boy who was left behind in the desert because he couldn't keep up. Broken ankles, being arrested by the Border Patrol. And their reasons for emigrating are the reasons, I think, why all of our ancestors would have wanted to immigrate to the U.S., which was an opportunity at a better life or to get away from violence, and you're looking at these portraits in the face. They're all installed at eye level. So you are really forced to sort of get rid of this idea of the border as an abstraction and face the people who make this journey.
Oh, that's interesting, because here's the thing. It is so dicey to give an experience like this to museum goers, right? There's
exactly
this danger of trivializing refugees and migrants' experience. I mean, this is life and death. And here
exactly.
You are in a museum, which is a kind of entertainment setting in many
Although
ways.
I would argue that museums shouldn't always be entertainment, but that's another debate. But I think, you know, I had that same concern going into it. I was like, is this going to be a Disneyfication of the border experience so, you know, people could go get their jollies and learn what the border is like? But I think Iñárritu makes the experience so powerful and so visceral and so personal, and he so humanizes it that you can't help but be moved by the experience. That if this was an abstract idea when you entered that room, boy, it is not when you leave it. And I think to have this debate at this time, when so many migrants from Mexico and Central America are vilified in the media, you know, the Trump comment about rapists and criminals, I think it's really important. You know, we live in a country that is based on the foundational myth of a dangerous crossing. You know, the Mayflower, 100 pilgrims who jammed into the hold of a ship to make that dangerous crossing to the U.S. You know, that is part of who we are. And that's what this journey is. And I think that's the story that Iñárritu's VR experience tells.
So it sounds like he transcends the possible ick factor with artistry.
Exactly. And I think there is, beyond the virtual reality, there's the installation aspect of it. So you are walking, you're not going in and just strapping on this VR headset and having this 6.5 minute experience. He is taking you through this whole sequence of experiences that put you in this mood, that put you in this place, that connect you with the people who have made this journey. So it's not just the 6.5 hours. I mean, I must have spent like a good 45 minutes in there just beyond the virtual reality.
Well, thanks so much for this, Carolina.
Thank you for having me.
Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. Coming up, Win Tran and his wife started an illegal underground dining club in his apartment, so he was good at coming up with creative workarounds. And he went to some unique lengths to keep his legal restaurant, Starry Kitchen, running.
I was going to do a clandestine poetry meetup and food delivery, and I would write haikus and limericks about Chuck Norris.
Adventures in Starry Kitchen, a memoir cookbook. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Win Tran knew he'd really made it in the restaurant world when inspectors from the health department threatened to shut him down. He and his wife, T, had been running an underground, illegal dining club out of their apartment kitchen. The meetups had become so popular that their home became LA's number one Asian fusion restaurant on Yelp. Eventually, the couple opened a fully licensed legal restaurant, Starry Kitchen, in 2010. But legitimizing amid a wave of critical acclaim didn't shield them from the pains of opening a restaurant, and Starry Kitchen closed 5 years later. Win and T are still cooking, though, and serving their crispy tofu balls and chicken wings at Echo Park's Button Mash. They've also turned their story and some of their recipes into a new cookbook, Adventures in Starry Kitchen. And Win Tran joins us now, and it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. I think this is amazing. You made the mistake in inviting me, so thank you.
Well, it's a long and journey with many turns. So let's start with the first iteration of Starry Kitchen. And this was this illegal kind of lunch restaurant in your apartment. Did you always dream of opening a restaurant? Is that where it started for you?
No way. I tried to fight that all my life. I didn't want to be that Asian guy that worked in a restaurant or was a Chinese cook or something like that. Even though I'm not Chinese, I understand that. So what happened was the fall of the economy, you know, I was working in film, an independent film. I used to go to Cannes, Sundance, Toronto, Berlin. I used to go to all these fancy film festivals. And my wife worked in advertising, and we both lost our jobs because of the fall of the economy. And she went on Facebook, and she was already cooking on Facebook and posting pictures. And everyone was like, you should cook. And eventually, 3 weeks later, I was like, honey, you ain't got anything to do. We should just start an illegal and underground restaurant of our apartment. And she's like, well, how do you do that? I'm like, don't worry, I figured it out.
Well, you know, I get it as someone coming to your illegal restaurant, how exciting that is, because you feel like you're doing something illicit. But what is it like to actually do that? I mean, to churn out 40, 60, 80 covers out of an apartment kitchen. How do you do that?
Nothing in life comes easy. I mean, that's the first thing. It's a lot of work. You know what it is, though? It's nothing to do with the kitchen setup. You realize when you cook, especially out of an apartment, is that it's all about organization, or the French term in most kitchens, mise en place. Like, you just have to prep enough and figure out how you portion that out. And, you know, the best advice we got was from a friend. He was the executive chef of the Beverly Hills Hotel. And he was like, you know what? You're going to run out of room. That's the first thing that's going to happen. And we realized that, because when we started exploding, we wanted to expand it, but there was no way to expand it because we had no more room to expand it outside of, we did Sunday lunch and Wednesday dinner. That is all we could physically manage out of our apartment. A lot of times we were out of food, which was a great problem to have, except for we wanted to grow it and we wanted to share our food with more people. And it wasn't really a business at that point in time. It was more like, this is a party that's growing. We want to share it with everyone.
Okay, how did you get busted?
Well, being the number one Asian fusion restaurant listing in all of Los Angeles on Yelp did not help. And we were actually, I think, the number one restaurant in all of North Hollywood, because that's where we were resided. And one day when we were serving, I saw this restaurateur who owned this Italian restaurant in one of the buildings that I lived in walking around my apartment. I was like, well, that's weird. Why is he walking around? I'm pretty sure he ratted us out. But I should be really clear. I should thank him too, because this is the turning point in all of Starry Kitchen. And the week after that, I remember coming home one day, just being out and about, and there was a card on our doorstep. Like, oh, wow, there's a card with a phone number. I turned it over, LA County Department of Health, and my wife was pissed. And I was like, oh, my God, this is what we've been waiting for. And they interrogated me, and I told them it was a dinner party. They didn't care.
Yeah, that's right. You had everyone pretend they were just your friends and
yeah.
just showed up.
Yeah, well, that, you know, because I knew the jig was up, I was like, here's now the script. And they came to our apartment, and then I'm that friend that everyone has that weasels their way out of everything. I'm that guy. Like, I was going to talk my way through all of it. And I knew as much of my argument as possible. Like, I didn't touch any of the money. We took donations. We served everyone. Because if you, you know, only businesses have the right to refuse business. But at a certain point in time, they were like, look, we're annoyed by you, but we're not going to do anything. So just shut it down. I was like, yes, sir, I will totally shut it down. And then the next week, we kept it going, Black Ops, for another 3 months, not telling anyone. And that made it more popular and made it more illicit and made the history and the just the future of Starry Kitchen just become that much more interesting. And we were already in the process of taking over a real restaurant. That's the thing that's really important. And I actually told the health department this after trying to weasel my way out of the argument. I was like, hey, look, man, let me just be honest with you. You should make me your poster child because I'm taking over a place with real licenses, real permits. Don't you want that? And they were like, no, we just want you to stop. And I was like, I don't understand why you wouldn't want me to do that because I'm not the only one in the city that does this. And I know you're cracking down. They're like, we don't care. I'm like, okay, man.
And eventually that was it. And you opened Starry Kitchen. And most restaurants close after a year these days. It's really rough. But you kept it going. But you hit some really hard times. At one point you had a shift where you announced you weren't going to be able to make payroll, right? And a couple of chefs quit. I think all of your chefs eventually quit in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and the harder part of that was like I was about to make payroll the day before and the state took all the money from me because I owed them money and I was trying to work with them and they didn't care. And the next day I had to tell my staff, hey, I don't have your money. The state has your money and I know you don't believe me and I wouldn't blame you for not wanting to work here anymore. And they did actually for the next 3 months. But what happened was that created a kind of tension in trying to pay my staff back. And the way I paid them back were not, and I'll admit it, were not the best ways to do it, but I had no other choice. Like, you know, my staff used to have pooled tips and I'd hold them back just for a couple of weeks so I could buy groceries to make more money to pay them back. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. 3 months later, my staff, I was telling them like, hey, you need to cook this better. And they're like, hey, we need our tips. And how was I going to argue with that? Like that was something that was very, they had every right to ask for when I actually offered that. And
that's
they had a
just bone against bone there. The margins are so small. So you did keep Starry Kitchen going for, what, 5.5 years? And eventually you had this ultimatum via Kickstarter, right? Either you raise a record $500,000 to open a new brick-and-mortar shop or you end Starry Kitchen. Was there a part of you that wanted to fail at this point after all of this struggling?
Wow, that is a very direct question I've never even thought of. I think there are many parts of me that wanted to fail many times in this because closure would be nice. But there's just something inside me, and I mean this very genuinely, that there's a fire inside me that needs completion. Like that literally is the focus of my life now. Like success is not as important as completing things. I mean, the hard part about the Kickstarter.
Well, what about your wife, though? She was in this, too.
Well, that's the reason why we did the Kickstarter. My wife's like, I've had it.
She's like, burnout.
She was told, well, we almost broke up like 3 different times at least over the restaurant business. And, you know, this was finally the decision I made to either push Starry Kitchen farther and abandon my wife or finally be on the same page with my wife and see if we could start Starry Kitchen back up again. And the Kickstarter was that decision. I was like, look, if we can raise all the money we need, will you do this? She goes, yes, only if we can get all the money we need. Otherwise, we're quitting.
And you didn't make it.
We didn't make it. I mean, raised 115 grand, which I still think is a lot of money. But I, you know, this is the way I kind of put it. Like, I'm a bad ex-boyfriend. I love too hard. And it's because I invest a lot of energy into it. And when I finally part ways, I just want to sever. And that was, you know, that's the way it had to be with Starry Kitchen. Like, we couldn't half-ass it. So we needed to walk away. And that's what happened.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Win Tran, and he's the author of the book Adventures in Starry Kitchen. It's part cookbook and part memoir about his time running the popular Pan-Asian restaurant Starry Kitchen. Let's talk about food, the real issue here. Your cookbook, your food, your kitchen, Starry Kitchen, I think it's fair to say it's Asian fusion cooking, although that's a controversial term.
It's all right.
Is that the food that you grew up eating?
Some of it, yes. Some of it, no. Like, I talk about this in the book, too. Like, I rejected Asian culture for, like, 18 years. So, I mean, some of this I ate. I didn't really enjoy it. I didn't learn to enjoy it until later on. My wife really opened my world up in terms of Asian food. She grew up in America, but she didn't grow up Asian American. She grew up Asian.
Right, and she's the cook.
And she's the cook. She's the executive chef. I learned everything from her. I do run the kitchen as well, so I take the chef title now with her. But no, these are just, you know, part of this is me overcompensating for the 18 years of unappreciation of Asian culture that I was never able to really appreciate, and to finally find that this is part of who I am and part of my background. And, you know, to be like, oh, my God, like, I didn't know these flavors existed. I want to share them with everyone.
So what has existed from the very beginning and shows up here in this cookbook?
Tit Kho, which is a Vietnamese dish it was the first dish we did out of our apartment. In English, we call it the caramelized coconut pork belly. That's a dish every Vietnamese kid knows around the world.
Oh, that leapt out at me from the book.
Did it? I hope it threw like a soft-boiled egg at you, too, because that's really good. It's an incredible dish, but it's peasant food. That's the best part about it. Like, it's a dish that's not served in most restaurants, but it's delicious. And our thing was, when we started Starry Kitchen, like, why not? And that's what we focused on, the things that we knew, and then we evolved from that, and things that other people knew, we would make them as well.
Well, the crispy tofu balls, everybody tried those. Everybody talks about those.
That's the game changer for people that hate tofu, that they're poor, they can't stand it, they don't know why they like it. We served it for 8 years. When we run out of it, people get livid, not in a funny way, too. They get really mad and tell me I'm stupid for running out of it.
Huh. Well, what is your favorite recipe to cook yourself?
Oh, my God. That is the Vietnamese minced beef. It's a ground chuck. It's marinated in fish sauce and curry and coconut. And then you mince it, and you sear it so it's kind of crispy, and you put it on a bed of rice that's stir-fried with salt and seasoning, and then you top it with pickled red onions and chiffonade mint, that's really fancy, thin-sliced mint, fish sauce on top of that, peanuts, other pickles. It's just so comforting. It has so much flavor. It's not actually as difficult to make as a lot of our other dishes, even though it's the most complicated in terms of assembly. It has a lot of ingredients. The most coveted dish might be the Singaporean chili crab. That will get you laid.
Good advice there. Well, you know, one thing I was thinking while I was reading your book, and a lot of it is about just how hard it is to run a restaurant. And you've done so many different versions of just delivering food, making food for people. You have this underground venue and the pop-up and the brick and mortar and this food delivery through Uber Eats and now the button mash up, I guess. Which one is most satisfying?
Oh, my God. The most satisfying. Can I give you two answers on that one? The most satisfying is probably the apartment when we started it, because it was very organic. It was not with any intention to grow any bigger than that. It became very bohemian, and I use that word not because I'm a big artist or like that. It was just really special to me, and I miss that time because it brought all these people together from different walks of life.
Right. It's so intimate.
It's really intimate, and I got to know them as much as they got to know us, and they were part of our history growing. The other part of that was one time when we first became a pop-up in the Fashion District, I needed to make extra money. And I figured out that I was going to do a clandestine poetry meetup and food delivery. And I would write haikus and limericks about Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris.
Yeah, I would, actually.
Of course, Chuck Norris.
And I would have to write them.
You'd get the poems with your food.
No, you would buy the poetry and get free food. Because the thing about it is that I'm experiencing this illegal and underground thing, and you can't pay for food that's not sanctioned or made in a kitchen that's not permitted. But if you pay for something else and you happen to give something free, like food with it, it's not. Okay, now I'm putting it on
there. Oh, you're working all the angles.
Yeah, I'm working on the angles, but you're paying for poetry that I hand wrote and I hand create. I created with my mind. Which is, by the way, one of the worst ideas ever, because I did the iambic pentameter about Chuck Norris, and that was very difficult. And it was very fulfilling.
I really want to read some of these
poems. My God, they're horrible. Like, I don't know why anyone paid for those, but thankfully
they
got out of
meal. They should be in the book.
I, yeah, the next book. I'm so sorry. I didn't think about that until now.
Wynn Tran, it has been so fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to go write some poetry now.
And I'm glad we can still eat your food through a number of different venues. Wynn Tran is the author of Adventures in Starry Kitchen. The book is part cookbook, part memoir about he and his wife and how they turned their underground apartment dinner parties into a hit LA restaurant. Coming up, is it wrong to buy exclusive rights to a color? The blackest black versus the pinkest pink. An art battle heats up. More on that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have you ever heard of Vanta Black? It's allegedly the blackest black there is. Some describe it as blacker than a black hole. It was originally only used for aerospace technology until one man got exclusive rights to use it in art. His name is Anish Kapoor. He basically owns Vanta Black. No one else can get their hands on it. And he has ignited a firestorm of criticism in the art world. So British artist Stuart Semple decided to fight back and create his own color, the pinkest pink, and he banned Kapoor from buying it. We have Stuart Semple on the line from London now to tell us all about this art battle, and thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Hello.
I understand you're painting right now, so I'm really sorry to interrupt.
No, I finished for the day, so it's perfect.
Lovely. What was your initial reaction when you heard that Anish Kapoor, and I should say for people who don't know him, this is this superstar sculptor who's known for the Chicago Silver Bean and that 375-foot spiral ladder for the London Olympics, among a lot of other pieces. So what did you think when he bought these exclusive rights to A Shade of Black?
Well, I was completely shocked. I mean, at first I saw Vanta Black and I thought it was absolutely awesome and I wanted to have a go, like a lot of artists did. And then it kind of came to pass that we found out Anish had the exclusive rights and we couldn't use it. And I think there was a lot of anger at that point, and I felt really disappointed as well.
Well, I know you said that Vanta Black is your favorite color. What is it about this color that is so appealing?
Oh, it's just incredible. It's like it sucks all light into it. It's like a black hole. If you coat things in it, it's almost like they disappear. I mean, artists have been on a quest for the ultimate black for so long, you know, all the way through art history. And it has now been created. That exists. And I would just love to use it in my work.
And another thing that's a little confusing about Vanta Black, is it a color or a technology?
It's difficult. At first, I think you could call it a technology. It was definitely a way of applying stuff to something. But it was definitely very black, and new iterations of it can be sprayed. So I'm starting to feel like it's definitely becoming a color. And at the end of the day, if Anish has exclusive rights to it, he's an artist. So I class it as an art-making material.
Well, so where does that leave the legality of it? Legally, can you patent or own a color?
Well, yes, you can. Pantone are a very famous creator of colors. And yes, of course, people trademark the color of their brands all the time. What's interesting about this is that artists are banned from this substance. Artists can't use it unless you're called Anish Kapoor. And that's what's a little bit annoying about the whole thing, really.
Right. That's what got your goat, right? So you came up with this idea to make the pinkest pink.
Yeah. Well, I've been making my own paints for like 15 years to use in my work. And I had already made a really awesome pink. And I decided actually I was as bad as him because I was keeping all my super colors to myself. So I thought, well, why don't I share my pink and make a point at the same time and ban him from using the pink. So I put it up on the internet just as a joke. And I just basically said, if you want to buy it, you have to agree to a legal disclaimer that you're not Anish Kapoor and you're not going to share it with Anish Kapoor. And to the best of your knowledge, information and belief, it won't make its way into the hands of Anish Kapoor. And before I knew it, it just blew up, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people were using the pink to make amazing art. It was just amazing.
Right. This comes under the hashtag share the black. So they blew up, as you said, and I was looking at some of the comments. What kind of reaction did you get online from the art community?
The majority of people were really, really supportive, actually, more than I thought. And it was a joke. So there's a lot of humor in it. And I think people really sort of joined in with that kind of joke, apart from Anish Kapoor. He didn't take it very well. I think it upset him a bit.
Right. Well, he weighed in. So why don't you tell us what his response was?
Yeah, well, basically, he broke the rules of the website. He got his hands on the pink, and then he dipped his middle finger in the pink, and he posted it on his Instagram, and he said, up yours. And then everything just went bananas after that, because everybody was quite upset. And it just took on a life of its own at that point, I think.
Well, then the dust up isn't over, right? I understand you're making other colors. You're making your own black. Okay, black.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically what happened was I wrote to him and said, look, please give the pink back or give me the £3.99 it cost and say sorry, and maybe we can be friends. And he just
much to ask.
No, I thought it was a nice request, but he just told BuzzFeed that he was going to sue me. So at that point, everybody started writing to me and telling me that I had to make a black. So I made a black. It was an all right black. And I sent it to 1,000 artists all around the world to tell me how to make it better. So we worked together as a community and everybody made suggestions. And we've now created Black 2, which is a really, really, really awesome black that all artists can use, apart from Anish, obviously. And we can all use a really good black. So what's kind of come out of all of this is that we've ended up with a better black. So artists now have a better black, which is actually really cool, I think.
Well, so Anish posted this, of course, online. How did people respond then to him? What kind of things were they writing?
I wouldn't want to repeat it on the radio. You'll have to have a look at his Instagram. But yeah, the comments on that post weren't very nice.
They didn't see humor in the pink is pink response.
No. No, and I don't know why. I mean, there's two ways to have taken the post. Either it was,
I thought it was funny.
I thought it was kind of like weird, like someone of his stature that sort of wading in on. I think the thing was that it's very sort of one-sided, and in terms of the art community, like he's quite an elite figure, and he doesn't really kind of talk or come out of his bubble that often. So for him to like come out and stick his finger up was like quite a big gesture in a way, I think.
Oh, if he doesn't regularly engage, I can see how that would stand out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's what it was. It's like, well, you've ignored us all for all this time, and now you've just come in and said up yours to us all. And by now, people really were quite into the pink and using it for their work, and there's quite a lot of good stuff being made. So they saw it really much, very much like he'd taken the black, stolen the pink, stuck his finger up, and then obviously he said he was suing me. So, you know, this kind of, it just isn't a good look, really. It looks a bit kind of greedy.
That's one word, yeah. So he's also moving ahead with Vanta Black. What's he done with it, this color that he owns that people want?
The problem with Vanta Black is it's so expensive to use. And you can only coat quite small things. So far, all he's managed to do is make these limited edition wristwatches. He's made 10 wristwatches with black back plates, but they're £100,000 each. So it's kind of like people are quite upset, because I think they thought he was going to make a big piece of public sculpture that we could all go and enjoy, like the work he's famous for, which he didn't. He just kind of made these really expensive watches. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a bit of a letdown for everyone, really. It wasn't very imaginative.
So are you worried about this lawsuit? Does he have standing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wake up every morning and run downstairs and check the mail in case there's a scary letter, and there isn't one. I've spoken to quite a few lawyers, and they don't seem to think that he's probably got much of a case, really, against me. So I'd probably be all right, I think.
Well, I wish you the best with Pink is Pink and Black 2 and all the colors. Stuart.
Thank you. Yeah, I kind of need a bit of a rest now. I've spent the last few months like all day and all night making paint, and I kind of want to get back to my paintings. But yeah, while people want them, I'll keep making them, I think.
Well, good luck with that. And thanks again.
Thank you.
Stuart Semple, he's an artist based in London. Christian Bordahl, master of listener comments.
Hello there, Barbara Begay.
What have you to say? Hello.
Well, let's see. We started the show on a pretty serious topic today, talking about physician-assisted suicide. California has a so-called right to die or aid in dying law. And yesterday, the California Department of Public Health reported 111 people had used it to take their lives in the first 6 months that the law, after the law had taken effect. Now, there's a lawsuit in part by doctors who want to see the law overturned. So we had an interesting discussion about that earlier in the show, and we also asked our listeners for their thoughts. Joey Kelly said end-of-life care should focus on the will of the patient, not the physician. Doctors should not have the final say on whether or not someone chooses to take their life when terminally ill. And Jessica Hastings says we give out dying pets more dignity than we do dying people in this country. I can't understand why anyone would oppose this. And Dante Durand, however, says eating healthy, exercise, and real cures not being suppressed by corporations are the answer, not Logan's Run.
That's the movie.
Yeah, you know, where people were killed at a certain age.
Yeah, right. Didn't leap to mind. But I thought it was interesting our guest discussed the two-sided sword of do no harm.
Yeah, exactly. And also the fact that people say, you know, they want to avoid pain. And in fact, there are a lot of ways to avoid pain now other than, you know, the ultimate way.
Right. And but they often fall deficient as well. And people who've been through this experience with their loved ones know that.
Yep.
Anyway, thank you for that.
Absolutely.
And thank you all for listening. It's been a great run here. You can tune in tomorrow for Press Play. Take care.